first of all, very much to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak. So, let me start by giving the motivation for what I'm going to talk about. It's desirable for various reasons to talk about the geometry of clouds of points that live in RD, in Hilbert space, or more generally in metric space. So I guess if you don't believe the first point, then there are a lot of applied mathematicians that find that desirable simply because, well, they get data, and data looks like data. Just the data that they get is just big clouds of points that live, well, in one of these spaces, either RD with D is very large, which you may as well think about as Hilbert space, or you change the metric a little bit and you have a metric space. Now in RD, there's tools of multiscale analysis that I'm going to talk about. And these tools are A, very nice, and B, very useful. So they're called quantitative rectifiability. And one thing that I'm very interested in is trying to push these tools into the category of metric spaces. So this is slightly off topic, I think, for many of you. So please feel free to ask as many questions as you want. So let me give you some sample questions that you can start off by thinking about. So you're given a set K in RD, and you can ask the question, when is the set contained inside one single curve of finite length, or one connected set of finite length? Those are the same questions up to a constant. And then you can try and get estimates for the length of the shortest such set, or up to constant, as everything I'm going to talk about today is up to constant, multiplicative. And we can try and see what these estimates depend on, so the number of points, the ambient dimension, and the answer to both of these questions is going to be no. But we'll get to that. So let me give you just two examples of what the sets that you should have in mind are for the talk. So one set is just, something like that. So let me actually draw a piece of it here. So you have something like this, and you want to know when, so this is already connected, you want to know when this has finite length and when it doesn't. And you want the answer to be given in terms of multiscale analysis. And the other set, I drew three iterations on the way to getting this set. This is just, so if you keep on going all the way over there, you should have what's called the Garnett example, so the 1/4 Cantor set. There is no curve of finite length that captures any measure of that set. So this is what's called purely unrectifiable. We'll keep these two examples in mind, I guess, throughout the talk. What is the intuitive picture for sets in RD? So a connected set, and so this was first done by Peter Jones for the plane and then extended by Kato Kikulu to RD, and I'm going to be more precise in a second, but the intuitive picture is that if you have a connected set, which is a finite length, then on most scales and in most locations, it's flat. So if you look at this picture, so you can have a lot of things like this, but if you're going to end up having finite length, then if you sort of take an arbitrary point and an arbitrary radius around it, the picture is going to look more or less like this. So we're going to make this quantitative in a second, but the point is that this can be used to characterize all subsets of finite length things like this. The goal is to make this quantitative. So I guess, is it clear what the setup is for now? So now we need some definitions. If there's one definition that you should remember for the rest of the talk, it's probably this one. A lot of the talk is going to be essentially trying to vary this definition and trying to get analogs and metric spaces for different categories of sets, and somehow, if you don't get this one, then please ask me. So beta is with respect to an underlying set K. So in this case, K is this sort of object with dendrites, and it's so you're measuring beta with respect to the set K of a ball Q. So Q can be either a ball or a cube. So right here, if you think about this as Q, then beta is the width of the thinnest tube that contains the set inside this ball. So, well, here it's pretty small, so the thinnest tube looks something like this. Hopefully it's not too small for those of you in the back. And then, of course, you scale this by the diameter of the ball. So what you end up getting is a quantity that's dimension or scale independent. So if you blow this picture up by any factor, then beta remains the same. Is this definition clear? Okay, feel free to ask me to go back to it later.
Why is there a factor 2 on top?
Just to conform to standards. So I want to say this. I want to say beta is between 0 and 1. Okay? Now it's between 0 and 1. No other reason. And everything I'm going to say is going to be at the constant anyway, so you may as well throw it away. So now this is in Q, and in a second your question will make a lot of sense to whoever doesn't know what the next slide is going to be. A theorem by Peter Jones says that if you have a connected set that lies in the plane, so this, if you sum over all cubes in the dyadic grid, so now Q is going to be a cube, not a ball, and what you're going to sum is, so now the K from the previous slide is gamma here now. So connected sets are going to be gammas in this talk. And K is, not connected sets, but could also be connected. Anyway, if you sum over all cubes in the dyadic grid, so this is a pretty big sum, the square of this quantity beta, that corresponds not to Q but to 3Q. So if you had a square in the dyadic grid, 3Q is just this thing. So this is Q, this is 3Q. So you square that, you weight it by the diameter. So now the left-hand side has dimension length, and the right-hand side has dimension length. So the point is, if you look at that sum, it's bounded up the constant by the, I wrote length of gamma. What I mean by length is always one-dimensional Hausdorff measure. Okay, so, at the very least, you should be somewhat surprised that this is even finite. So this is not such an easy theorem to prove. It's a lot of complex analysis, the way Peter Jones proved it. And you can ask yourself, or you can ask me, why the sum on the left-hand side is even interesting. And the answer is that, if you're just given any old set K that lies in RD now, there exists a connected set, gamma 0, which contains K, such that the length of gamma 0 is bounded by this weighted sum, this time with respect to K, plus the diameter of K. So let me just say one word about what you have down here. So suppose your set K was something that looked like this. Okay, so it's totally flat. So beta is always 0. So you still want to find the connected set that contains it, which is essentially the only reason why you need this diameter. So theorem 2 was proved via an explicit construction. So how does this construction roughly work? So you start off by taking two points that give you the diameter, drawing a line through them, continuing a bit more to the right and a bit more to the left. And then you just start modifying this line to fit your set. And it turns out that the cost of these modifications is something that you can control by this one. So theorem 2 is for RD, theorem 1 was for the plane, Kato Kikiulu, and extended theorem 1 to the category of RD. Any questions so far? Yes?
Right. What about the RD proof?
So the RD proof was totally geometric, actually. So in a few minutes I'm going to change RD to Hilbert space, and then later on it's going to be a metric space. And so you throw away complex analysis as fast as you can. But this was hard. I mean, it was non-trivial to redo this without the complex analysis. I think this was part of her PhD thesis, actually, in the 90s, like 90 or 91 or 92. So a corollary of just putting these two theorems together is that if you have any connected set, one way of measuring its length is you take its diameter and you add that sum. And, well, more generally, if you have a set K and you care about the shortest connected set or the shortest curve that contains K, so two different objects but at the constant they have the same length, so one way of getting that length is just by looking at diameter plus the sum of beta squared times diameter. Minimal spanning tree or minimal Steiner tree. Well, Steiner tree is probably the right name. Computer science terminology. I'm not going to have any proofs other than this one today, simply because they're all way too long. But this is very easy to prove, so I may as well show it. So the length of the shortest curve that contains the set K is, of course, bounded by the length of the set that one can construct. The length of the curve that one can construct by theorem 2 was the diameter plus the weighted sum of the beta squares. That's in turn bounded by the diameter plus the weighted sum of the beta squares, which correspond now to the curve that contains K instead of K. So remember, the way beta was defined, it was the thinnest tube containing something. So if you make that something bigger, then beta does not decrease. And then that's in turn by theorem 1 controlled by the length of the shortest curve containing the set. So everything works. Okay, so, well, I guess, are there any questions? So by now you didn't ask questions, so I can go on. So one reason why this theory is nice is that there's a dictionary between these beta numbers, so Jones beta numbers, and wavelet coefficients. And you can somehow use this dictionary to sometimes guess theorems from one category in another category, sometimes to actually get, some transfer proofs. I think the second to last slide that I have in this talk is going to be of a theorem that, and the way to obtain that theorem was in some sense a transfer of proof. What does this dictionary say? So you take the wavelet coefficients and they correspond to beta numbers. The analysis of a curve corresponds to the analysis of a function. You have L2 information about that connects the wavelet coefficients and the L2 norm of the function. You have an L2 type statement here. So somehow philosophically there's a statement here that length is an L2 quantity, which is a little bit weird. But it's a useful thing to keep in mind. And then you have the wavelet square function and the Jones function, which is simply sum of beta squared 3q, where q contains x. So this is Zx. Towards the end of the talk, I'll maybe say a few more words about this. So I guess first question that comes to mind after you see this should be, is this a Euclidean theory? The first notion is that even in Hilbert space, everything that I've said is false. So I wrote the theorems in small on top. So you have that 3q over there, which is on one hand totally necessary. On the other hand, it puts you in bad shape because if you look at the data grid, so this is just a single scale in the data grid. You actually have all scales. But if you take these three points as your set k, then, all of these in this plane, all these 9 cubes, will see these 3 points when you look at 3Q. And so beta squared is going to be at least, I don't know, 1/6 or 1/9 or something like that. And, well, that means trouble because we have 9 of those cubes, and 9 is just 3 squared, and everything grows exponentially with dimension. So in order to go to Hilbert space, a basic thing to do is to, well, you can get rid of the 3 because you do need some overlapping, but you do want to, well, you need to get rid of the dyadic grid. So you need to get rid of the dyadic grid, and then, I'll show how to do this in a second. That helps you go into Hilbert space, and then if you want to keep going into metric spaces, then you need to think about a different definition for beta. Because so far we define beta using tubes around straight lines. So that's not going to work. So it turns out that one can reformulate this for Hilbert space. I actually said everything on this slide already. Let's see what we need to do. So what I have on this slide is the replacement for the dyadic grid. Okay, so, well, the main problem with the dyadic grid is that it's not, it has no connection to the set whatsoever. So we have an underlying set K, or something not connected, it doesn't matter. The point is we want our multiscale, so the multi-resolution, so the collection of all balls or cubes at different scales and locations to somehow depend on the set. So you take a 2 to the minus n net for your set K. So what that means is just a maximal 2 to the minus n separated subset. And around each point of this, you do this so that you're nested. So after you do this for a given n, in order to do this for n plus 1, then you just extend. So you do this so that xn contains xn minus 1, and you just look at the collection of balls such that, on the scale n, you take a look at balls of radius a times 2 to the minus n, where a is some constant which, is larger than 1, but it's actually, in order to make theorem 2 work, in order to make theorem, 2 work the way I order them, you need a to be larger than some constant a0, which, I don't know, think about as 1,000. So let's just draw what GK looks like for this set. So on one scale, you're going to have something like this. And then, finer scales, you also need to add to the picture, but then you're not going to be able to see much of it. Given this replacement for the dyadic grids, the same theorems, as stated before, all more or less, hold in Hilbert space, so for RD independently of D. And, the main obstacles in proving this, first of all, theorem 1 was much harder to prove than theorem 2. The main obstacle in proving theorem 1 was that you no longer, a lot of nice, very nice things happen to you when you have a dyadic grid. So this is a very nice filtration. You have nesting properties. It's doubling. I mean, you have a lot of tools. So you're in a non-doubling case now. This was quite a lot of work. Maybe I should pause for questions for a second. Yes. So this reproves what she did. In some sense, it follows the general outline that she laid out. So that's a whole other talk. This is somehow supposed to be an introduction, so I shouldn't get into this. It generalizes. It takes what she does and it pushes it further. What you end up doing is you end up constructing some weights as a martingale, and these weights have nice properties, and on one hand, and on the other hand, they control these beta numbers. I'm not really saying anything because I don't have time. Okay, so, well, as a corollary, you can just redo everything you, well, the one-line proof that I showed before, and any set K in Hilbert space, one way of measuring the shortest curve containing it is by looking at this sum. Okay, so, well, so what this gives us is a multi-scale geometric characterization of subsets of finite length sets. And it would be very nice to push this into a metric space. And, well, so around the same time as this was done, there were one other person called Imo Haloma, so he was a student of Pertti Mattila in Finland, and Ferrari, Franchi, and Peugeot. Well, they're from various places. So they were working on different metric versions of this. So I'm going to describe Imo Haloma's work for a few minutes now. And for that, I need to define Menger curvature. So what is Menger curvature? So suppose you have three points in a metric space. Yeah, so you have three points in a metric space. Well, just by virtue of them being three points, you can find three points in the plane. They have the same distances. Well, they have the same mutual distances as the ones in the metric space did. You can draw a circle through these three points. So suppose this is a circle through these three points, and you can look at the radius of the circle, and you define the Menger curvature of these three points to be 1 over, so this is c squared, to be 1 over r squared. So the Menger curvature is 1 over r. Okay, so again, these three points don't necessarily lie in the plane, they lie in the metric space, but you can find points in the plane that have the same mutual distances. So this is sort of a high school geometry exercise, or, well, grade school geometry, I don't know. Okay, so, well, let me, so before you read that, let me draw a triangle and say something about it. Well, suppose these were my three points, and this is A, B, C. So assume that A is smaller equal to B, smaller equal to C, and that C is smaller up to a constant than A. So all distances are now comparable. So, and this distance is H. So H squared divided by, well, say, C, so essentially let me write by the diameter, is comparable to A plus B minus C, which is comparable to C squared multiplied by diameter cubed. So, well, first of all, notice that everything that I wrote has units of length, so there's some reality check that, well, so it's hopeful that what I wrote is true. To prove this, you use the Pythagorean theorem, and to prove this, you use a little bit of trigonometry. Sorry. Well, this is Menger curvature. So this is a bad choice of letter. So this is really, maybe I should write 1 over r squared. Thank you. Okay, so, well, if you look at this, this should remind you of the quantity beta squared times diameter. Right? So if you have these three points, then the height should remind you of beta, right? It's almost a deviation from a best fitting line. It's, well, up to a factor, it's that for these three points. So h squared divided by diameter is beta squared times diameter. Okay, so this quantity, Menger curvature squared times diameter cubed, is a good quantity because it's a metric space quantity, and, well, so one can define beta of that corresponds to a ball, so beta squared times diameter, to be diameter cubed times the supremum over all triples, where the points have comparable distances to each other, of the Menger curvature squared. Okay, so Imam Halama was the one to make this definition. Is it clear why this definition sort of makes sense? Okay, and indeed if you use that definition, then, well, given a set K in any metric space, and for normalization we want to assume that the diameter of K is 1, the reason for that is because of the way I defined GK. So now we're not going to talk necessarily about a connected set or a curve, because my metric space may be disconnected, but I can say that there exists a subset of 0, 1, and a Lipschitz function from the subset to K, such that the Lipschitz norm is bounded by the diameter plus this multiscale weighted sum of the beta numbers, or beta squared. So this is just, it is a metric space version of theorem 2, or theorem 2 prime as I have it here. And, so I briefly mentioned this, let me say just one word about this. So Ferrari, French, and Peugeot, around the same time, gave another version of theorem 2 for the Heisenberg group. They had yet a different definition of beta, since I'm not going to get into that, I don't even want to give the definition of beta that they used. Time moves fast. You want to know when the converse, meaning the theorem 1, is true, right? Because we saw that these two theorems, when you put them together, actually have a lot of power. It turned out that it's very easy to construct a counterexample, meaning to show that theorem 1 just does not hold. So if you look at a subspace, in the two-dimensional version of L1, so the plane with the taxicab metric, and you take a straight line and you grow a horn of size delta in the middle, and then two horns of size delta over 2, and four horns of size delta over 4, and so on, then, the length that you get is 1 plus n times, and, you do this for n stages, or n steps. So what I drew here was 3 steps. This is n equals 3. The length that you get is 1 plus n delta, and sum of beta squared times diameter, if you do everything in the taxicab metric, is n delta log delta inverse. Okay, so essentially what happens is, if you compare this to the Euclidean metric, what you lose is the power of squaring. So, you have the delta that corresponds, beta squared in the L1 metric that corresponds to these 3 points, in the L1 metric is delta, and in the Euclidean metric it would be delta squared. In any case, you don't have a theorem 1, and now one wants to find the category where you do have a theorem 1. Okay, so in order to do that, we sort of go deeper. So up until now, I've been talking about quantitative rectifiability, and now I want to start talking about what's called uniform rectifiability. So now I need 2 definitions. So we're going to be talking about Alfvers David regular sets. So a set K is called M Alfvers David regular if for any point in the set X and any radius around that point, which is not too big, the M dimensional Hausdorff measure of a ball around the radius R around X intersect K has size which is proportional to R to the M. Okay, so if M equals 1, we're trying to exclude things curved like this, or things that are too thin, but those are harder to draw. We want to define, so up until now we had what you should be thinking about as an L-infinity version of beta, meaning we took the supremum of the distances. Here we have an average version of the distances. So So beta, so you're averaging in the LQ metric, respect to measure mu, which we should think about as the Hausdorff measure of restricted decay. Well, it's just the average deviation. It's the average deviation from the best fitting line. The best fitting M-plane in this case, because we're talking about M-dimensional sets. So the reason I'm not just talking about M equals 1 is that, as you're going to see pretty soon, I want to start also going up in dimension. So not just to talk about finding good curves that contain the set, but sort of higher dimensional analogs of this. Questions? Okay, so what Guy David and Steven Sems proved was that if you have a 1 alpha, well, they proved more than that. This is a special case is what they proved. So if you have a 1 dimensional alpha regular set, alpha David regular set, so I guess for M equals 1, people call this alpha regular many times. Q between 1 and infinity, inclusive, then the following are equivalent. So K is contained inside the 1 alpha regular set, is one condition. Another condition is on the beta numbers, so it's a Carlson condition. It says that beta squared times diameter, where beta is with respect to any Q between 1 and infinity inclusive. So if that sum is always smaller than R, where you took that sum only over balls that were contained inside a ball of radius roughly R, I forgot how I started that sentence, but you have this Carlson condition where the sum on the left-hand side is bounded by a constant multiple of the radius. I was trying to make a statement that was too long for my own good. There are three other conditions. So K has big pieces of Lipschitz images, K has big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images, and K is good for all script K kernels. I want to actually tell you what these are. Let me tell you what these are, and then I'll also tell you that you can make statements like this for M bigger than 1. Let me first tell you what these statements are, because as far as I'm concerned, these are going to become the main objects pretty soon. So what does having big pieces of Lipschitz images mean? So you have a set K, and you're assuming that it's M regular. So if it's easier for you to think just about M equals 1. Big pieces of Lipschitz images means that if you take any ball, like the balls that we've discussed previously, so you take a point in the set, you take a radius that's no bigger than the diameter of the set, then you have a then you can capture at least a proportion of theta of the measure of this ball intersect K by the image of a Lipschitz function. Okay, so, and it's an image of a Lipschitz function that has its domain a subset of the radius R ball in Euclidean space. So if M equals 1, this means that, so if this is, well, so this hap- this is in your metric space, so this means that if your set looks sort of like this, then, well, I can capture at least part of it as the image of a Lipschitz map. The way I drew this, it's clear what my Lipschitz map should be, right? I should just trace what I did. But, well, I didn't have to. I could have taken a part of it that corresponds to this constant theta. So so this means that it has big pieces of Lipschitz images with constants L and theta. Questions? Okay. What does big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images mean? Well, the same thing, except now instead of requiring the map to be Lipschitz, I require it to be bi-Lipschitz. So that means that in this picture, I could not have done this. That would have been bad. What I am allowed to do, though, is, I can, but because of the way I drew this, I can take just this piece, or just this piece, or something like that. Notice that my piece doesn't have to be connected because I'm allowed to take a subset of the ball. A subset of the ball. Wasn't pointing out the right thing. And Well, let me also say what good for all k kernels mean. So you think about a specific we're thinking about a specific family of singular integrals, and for those singular integrals, so you have kernels from Rd minus 0 to R, which are odds, and have a certain decay, then the corresponding maximal function is L2 bounded. So, to be honest, I'm not going to be talking about this condition at all for the rest of the talk, but somehow, for completeness, I wanted to include it simply because, well, I'm sure a lot of you care a lot about these. Well, I know a lot of you care a lot about these types of integrals. Okay, so now let's go back to this. So it turns out that all of these things are equivalent for one L4th regular set. So, okay. In particular, this is also called uniform rectifiability. So any one of these equivalent conditions plus, so actually there's a book by David and Sims that contains about 5 million other conditions, all of which are equivalent, and they're all called uniform rectifiability, or sets that are uniformly rectifiable. Okay, but they do much more. So they do this for M alphas David regular sets. And then, well, you need to make sure that Q, so the way in which you measure deviation from an M-plane is in a certain range. And then, again, you get that the Karlsson condition is equivalent to having big pieces of Lipschitz images, which is equivalent to having big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images, which is equivalent to being good for a very large family of singular integrals. Questions? Okay, so now my goal is to try and convince you that there's hope of pushing this into metric spaces. I'm not going to talk about singular integrals, so I'm going to talk about the Karlsson condition, big pieces of Lipschitz images, and big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images. And as you're going to see, some of the pieces we already know how to do, other pieces we don't know how to do. Let's see. Okay, so yeah, again, this is a question. Can we push this into a metric space setting? Okay, so we start with M equals 1, simply because that's the easiest case. You're going to see that we know how to do everything for M equals 1. Let's start by the definition of beta. So it turns out that the right definition of beta, well, so you define beta squared times diameter by the triple integral of the Menger curvature. And this triple integral is over triples inside, so I wrote here inside K intersect ball ZR. Ball ZR should be Q. So you take triples that have distances which are comparable to each other. A times the distance. So, yeah, okay, that's fine. So you assume alpha regularity, and you look at this integral over triples, which are not too close to each other, and this is just the average Menger curvature. Well, it's the integral of the Menger curvature. Let's see that this has sort of the right units. So this looks roughly, well, this has dimensions 1 over length squared. In the setting of Alforth regular, so when you integrate, you're going to gain a diameter, roughly, of the constant. So you have 1 over length squared times diameter cubed, so this has the right scale. Right? This looks like length, which means that beta is dimension-free. Okay, and, well, if you make that definition, then you have a theorem, again, by Imo Halama, that says the following. So it says that if you have a one Alforth regular set and you're in a complete geodesic metric space and you have a Karlsson condition. So for any Z and for any radius which is bigger than zero, you could also just restrict this to be radius smaller than the diameter. That doesn't matter. You have that sum is bounded by a constant times a radius. So that's our usual Carlson condition. Then you have a one alpha regular connected set gamma, which contains K. And the only reason to assume complete geodesic is that you actually have a connected set gamma. Otherwise, you can again play this game by having a subset of 0, 1. And with essentially no work, this gives, this was a lot of work. This statement on the bottom in parentheses is no work. It just says that if you have a Carlson condition, then you have big pieces of Lipschitz images. Why? Well, you have a single Lipschitz image. So in particular, you have big pieces of Lipschitz images. Okay, and, well, the reason this is nice is because you also, or this is nice on its own, however, you also have the converse. So it turns out that if you have a connected one-alpha regular set in a metric space, then, if you look at that sum, then you actually have that control. So you have a Carlson condition. And, well, this time with a little bit more work, you get that big pieces of Lipschitz images implies a Carlson condition. When am I supposed to finish? Okay, sorry. Well, actually, I don't have that much left to say. Okay, that's good. So right now we have we have a connection between the first two parts and a connection to big pieces of Lipschitz images. And it turns out that for any m bigger or equal to 1, if you start off with an m all-force David regular set, then if you have big pieces of Lipschitz images, you also have big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images. So what am I saying? What I'm not saying is that if you have... what did big pieces of Lipschitz images say? It said, for any ball, I have a function that satisfies certain Lipschitz properties. I'm not saying that that same function is going to satisfy bi-Lipschitz properties. I am saying I'm going to find a different function, and this different function is actually going to be a subset of the first function, so it's just going to have a subdomain, and that function is going to be bi-Lipschitz, and it's going to be defined on a large enough domain so that you're going to have big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images. Okay, and well, as a corollary, you get that for m equals 1, you have big pieces of Lipschitz images, if and only if a Carlson condition, if and only if big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images. I do have time to explain this theorem. So this theorem is the explanation for why big pieces of Lipschitz images implies big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images. So this is how you go from a Lipschitz function to a bi-Lipschitz function. So what does this theorem say? It says that if you have a function that's defined on 0, 1 to the k into some metric space, and you assume that this function is one Lipschitz, there is a universal constant. That's of course independent of this function. Such that you can break up the domain, so you can break up 0, 1 to the k into a bunch of sets, f1 to fm, plus a remainder. And on each of these sets, this function is bi-Lipschitz. So if you have two points that are in the same fi, this function is bi-Lipschitz there, so the distance between the image of any two points is not just bounded above, but it's bounded below. You could say, well, that's easy. I just have all of these be the empty set. But we also know that the remainder is small. So I need to define that version of small. Let's just define h sub k of e is the infimum of some diameter b I to the power of k, where the union of bi contains e.
So this is called the k-dimensional Hausdorff content.
Okay.
So what this means is that, well, you capture a good chunk of the set. So this is sort of, in some sense, this says that your function is mostly invertible. So you can get that by taking the limit as alpha goes to zero. So I'm out of time. Let me just say one thing about the proof of this and then conclude. So originally this was a theorem by Peter Jones where his metric space was just RD. And the way in which he proved this was to say, well, okay, this isn't exactly how he proved it, but this is totally analogous to how he proved it. What he did, so what's analogous to how he proved it was to take F, look at F prime, and look at the wavelet expansion of F prime, and study the wavelet coefficients. It turns out that you can take, you can replace the study of wavelet coefficients by a study of beta numbers that correspond to the image of this function F. Actually, to be more precise, beta numbers that correspond to the function F. But again, I haven't told you how to define these beta numbers, so this is a little bit vague. But the point is that this is one place where this analogy between wavelets and beta numbers really comes into play. So just to conclude, I haven't given you a Carlson condition. So if you look at, let's go back to, this slide. So, what we've said was that for m equals 1, we know how to show that everything is equivalent. For m not equals 1, we know that big pieces of Lipschitz images are the same as big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images. I don't know what the right Carlson condition is. So I have some definition of beta numbers, because otherwise I could not have proven this. But that definition of beta numbers is not good enough to give me the right Carlson condition. So this is, as far as I'm concerned, a very interesting open question. What is the correct Carlson condition? And one final point is that this notion of big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images is very related to questions that people ask in computer science. So a very standard question to ask is, standard theorem to say is, I have this metric space, then I can, and I assume some things, and I can embed some chunk of this metric space into RD. This is a similar type of statement. You assume something, and you can embed a certain chunk of your space into RD, except, well, you assume something pretty strong, and you get a pretty strong embedding, namely into RM. But this also comes in an if and only if form. So if you have these embeddings, then you also have this condition. So, there's more to be said there, but I'm out of time. So, thank you. The computer science version of the traveling salesman. Is that what you're asking? So the one-dimensional case is called the analyst traveling salesman problem, right? So in computer science, you can ask the question of finding the shortest tour that doesn't go back on itself as far as nodes are concerned, that will go through a bunch of points. This is sort of an analysis version of this.
I remember John saying to himself that his methods actually gave some proof that one of the popular algorithms for doing traveling salesman correct us with.
Right. So this is, so I guess I should go all the way back. I'm pointing at the wrong place. The proof of this theorem is given by construction. If you actually look at what this construction is, then it's very close to being farthest insertion. So what is farthest insertion? You order all your points in such a way that first you put a line through the two farthest points in your set. Then you take the point that's furthest away from these two points and you modify the curve that you have to get to going through that point. And repeat. The algorithm that's used here is more or less that algorithm.
So my real question is that, I mean, that was for Euclidean distance,
right.
Point, and have some other distance.
Right.
Is what you're doing have some...
So, yes. So this is more or less the same construction. So yeah. That's true. Well, that's why I said more or less. But you can still talk about distances. So if you look at Imo Halama's, so
even playing the plane, you could just say what the distance between two points is. You could describe a different distance
from the Euclidean
distance.
Sure.
You could say the cost for going from one point.
Right, and yes, it is. So in particular, the way this theorem is proved is by a very analogous construction. So you take two points that have distance diameter between them, and this is now the distance with your new cost function, and you connect them by a geodesic, and now you start modifying this geodesic. So to be honest, it's not entirely how this was written, but this is equivalent. The way this was written was more in terms of orderings on these points. But eventually this is all the same. Other?